And so let's continue our conversation about Napoleon, which, yeah, having just, which we should have recorded some. So I will repeat for the listeners what that. So last night I'm sitting with Mark and his wife, who really keeps him in line. I got to say that Vivian keeps him totally in line. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
because that sucker needs to be corralled. So we're two hours and 58 minutes of the thing, or 2 hours and 38 minutes, 158 minutes overall. So it ends, and the most perfect review of this film was Mark's reaction right after the movie ended. The credits start rolling, and here's Mark right over to my right, and he goes, "Huh."
That's still funny. Still funny.
That was it. That was like the perfect review.
Can be taken many ways, but still funny.
Whatever. You know,
there it is.
Huh. I'm having an issue with all of these things.
2.5 hours. If all that generates is,
that's not a good situation.
Yeah. Where was I when you guys were at that?
Yeah,
I was at Emerald Fennell's new film. Saltburn.
You see, so you were that was the Hollywood Cemetery, right?
The one I went to was down at the Ace, some sort of premiere, blah blah blah, thing down at the Ace, where we have the big film week thing there, and it was all fine. And I got to tell you about the same review. Well, here's the thing. I liked it the first time I saw it when it was called The Talented Mr. Ripley, which I liked many years ago when it was called Purple Noon or something, whatever that Frenchman was. Adapted from. So I've seen this movie many, many times. I always like it, but I have seen it.
Yeah. Yeah, there it is. Oh, my. I mean, it is not turning out to. Everyone thought this would be a great year. I don't know, man. I mean, the taste of things is the one that I've most enjoyed, which is the Tran Anh Hung film with Juliette Binoche, and I was Mark and Vivian and I were at an event with her at the French consul's house the day before yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing Ferrari tonight. It's funny, we have the same schedule. I'm seeing Mark and Vivian every night this week.
Guys are seeing all the good movies.
Seeing Ferrari tonight and seeing Color Purple tomorrow. Going to the premiere of Color Purple tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm at Saltburn and Next Goal Wins and Hunger Games, Battle of the Songbirds and Snakes. That's what I'm doing. You guys at the French freaking consulate, and I'm over with the damn Hunger Games prequel.
Sorry about that.
I'm on the show this week, so it is what it is. But it's that time of year, and you're all right, of course. I've seen a few films that I thoroughly enjoyed. The historical drama about Baird Rustin.
I haven't watched that yet.
Coleman Domingo playing this figure who's a very important figure that not enough people know who Baird Rustin is. The reason there was a March on Washington is because of Baird Rustin, the guy who's standing to his left, Martin's left, and nobody knows his name. But that's the thing about those histories. There are always those people in those histories.
I am very much looking forward to seeing American Fiction. I don't know if you've seen the trailer for it, because we've known each other for over 30 years, and have you seen the trailer for American Fiction?
I have seen the trailer for American Fiction, yes.
I watched that trailer, and I'm like, this is about Tim. I swear, this is significantly about Tim.
I'm not even going to disagree with you. Jeffrey Wright, I'm looking at him, I'm like, oh my God. It's okay. Yeah, but I haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen that. I still have to see it, too. So looking forward to that. I don't know, man. As you say, the year, it's feeling like the films that will be contenders are films we've already seen.
Oppenheimer.
Certainly Oppenheimer, certainly something around Barbie, certainly the script for Barbie anyway. A few of those. But I don't feel, me not a big fan of Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah,
a movie I appreciate, but I'm not going to be handing any awards to.
Right.
Which means that whatever it's going to be, I haven't seen The Color Purple yet, the musical adaptation of The Color Purple that's coming up.
Yep. Seeing that night after Thursday.
I think I'll be back on the schedule with you guys by then. So we'll see what happens with that. But I don't know. I feel like Poor Things, Yorgos Lanthimos, was actually more, because I'm very hit and miss with Yorgos.
Same here.
But it'll be an interesting, year. Cause I know this, I know the Academy needs some big movies to be nominated for Academy Awards.
Yeah.
All of them, really. And at the moment, the big movies, Barbie and Oppenheimer, those are the only two.
It's feeling like it.
You know, there certainly aren't 10.
No, I don't think there's going to be 10. I think we, you know, it's feeling, I mean, I wish they'd go back to 5. I really do.
Yeah.
But it is feeling like maybe an 8 year, like maybe 8 films, maybe.
Yeah.
But they got to fix that. And, you know, I have furnished the Academy the data on this, by the way. I have furnished them the data that demonstrates that when they have more than 5 nominees, they get a split, they spread the wealth more, and the result is that they get lower ratings. I have shown them that data. I don't know what they're going to do, because what they don't want to do is get back to being criticized. Why didn't you nominate this film and that film? And it's like, because you can only get 5, you know, go back to 5. It'll work out better for you.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of our obits here, real quickly. Since we were last on, Piper Laurie left us. And Piper Laurie, of course, had at one point been married to our friend and colleague, Joe Morgenstern, formerly of the Wall Street Journal, now retired happily and absolutely ageless. So feel very bad for Joe, because they were still close.
Yeah.
Suzanne Summers left us. Burt Young left us, and Richard Roundtree.
Yeah. Look, I want to talk about Richard, but I'm gonna talk about Suzanne for a second.
Yeah,
because I used to run into Suzanne a lot. She lived in North Hollywood, where the wife and I lived, or in Toluca Lake, anyway. You know, that area, many years ago, early '90s. We're talking early-mid-90s, and would run into her all the time. She was a fabulous person, just a real everyday, you know, gal.
Yep.
And she had this lounge act that she did at this club up on Cahuenga that she saw the shame. She would always just, you know, bring us in. We'd sit down. And Suzanne Summers had an extraordinary voice.
Yes, she did.
You know, there was a time in history when she could have made a living just singing. And you know, sometimes, you know, particularly guys of a certain age, we get stuck with these images of people. So Chrissy Snow, you know, with the blonde, you know, all that kind of stuff. Let me tell you something. Suzanne Summers was incredibly smart in a whole bunch of ways.
Yeah.
And she built a career for herself out of just about nothing, in this town, and never, ever, ever complained about, you know, any of those little boxes that we put people in, you know, blonde, she was good to go, Suzanne Summers. And we forget about that fantastic contraption that I almost killed myself using. I don't know where it came from. Whether she just endorsed it or invented it. The ab flex. Remember that thing?
Yeah, I do.
It was the
thigh master or whatever it was. Yeah, the thigh thing.
Yeah, I almost hurt myself many trying to use that thing. So love me some Suzanne Summers. Yeah.
She was married forever to Alan Hamill. And I don't know really what his job ever was. They were immensely happy. They, even in their senior years, talked way too much about their sex life. I mean, you know, she would do these interviews. Oh, I can't wait to just grab him and throw him down. It's like, oh, sweetie, I don't need to go there. But all I remember about Alan Hamill was that he was the TV spokesman for Lucky Supermarkets for years until they merged with Ralph's or something, and Vaughn's, whatever it was. And then he went away. Did he do anything else? I don't know.
I don't remember. Look, Alan is a forever hep cat. I would see him on red carpets with Suzanne, and you had to ask Alan, dude, what are you wearing? And it would always be something like Armani. Alan was that guy. So, you know, I could see why she was hot for Alan. He was a hep cat. Alan's still alive.
Talk about Roundtree, man. You know, we've had some conversations about him since that passing, and I mean, I think a much more pivotal figure. What I brought up in our last conversation was people have to stop referring to Shaft as a blaxploitation film, because it was a studio film.
Mm-hmm.
It was a straight up mainstream studio film. It did not belong to the exploitation genre of the time. And that made Roundtree one of the most significant black leading men since Sidney Poitier. A real breakthrough part in a novel which was very successful and popular prior to the film. So all that being said.
Yeah, and of course, it's really funny. You know, again, Richard is one of those guys that, oddly enough, Richard Roundtree is a person that came into the homes of folks in the black community way before Shaft did, because Richard was on the box of many hair care products that we used. You know, Stay Soft Fro and Afro Sheen. If you look right at that box, the brother that you were looking at was a very, very young 19, 20, 21-year-old model named Richard Roundtree for Ebony Fashion Fair, and he was a brilliantly trained actor too, National Ensemble Theater, which is founded by our good friend Robert Hooks, good friend of Francesca, Robert Hooks, Kevin Hooks' dad, and just this
Trouble Man.
And that National Ensemble Theater, Negro Ensemble Theater, National Negro Ensemble Theater gave us Richard Roundtree as well as Lou Gossett Jr. and Glenn Turner. It's just so many you can't even begin to name. So that's where Richard was trained. So people think sometimes that these guys just sort of get plucked. No, trained professional actor. And the first thing Richard would have said to anybody, if you're gonna eulogize me, tell everybody what you just said, Wade, that Shaft is not a black exploitation film. Nope. He didn't have any trouble with black exploitation cinema, but Shaft wasn't that. No. Barry Gordy's son, as you always point out, Barry Gordy Jr.,
Gordon
Parks.
Yes.
Gordon Parks' son, Gordon Parks Jr., thank you, did make a black exploitation film, May Superfly.
Yeah.
So the son
diametrically the opposite.
Dad did not make a movie about a pimp and selling drugs. Gordon Parks. No, he made a movie about a black man with authority, the authority to traverse many communities, including, the established community of the police and all of that, that gangster community. And of course, his own community, that black community that he was walking around in, that black leather jacket. And that's a completely sort of different dynamic than what was in many of those black exploitation.
And you know, I always like to try to help people understand what the moment of Shaft was all about, because there is a real sea change there. And black exploitation films had been in the mix for a while. We had independent films, which were not necessarily exploitation films, of which Gordon Parks had been a part as well. And it was kind of pivoting away from Sidney Poitier, which you've often brought up many times, is like, that guy had an unrealistic burden on him to be sort of carrying the dignity and the public image of every civil rights era black person in America. I mean, he almost couldn't be a villain. He couldn't be a lot of those. He had to be this symbolic figure. And at a certain point, a lot of people, other actors said, I got to do something else. And there's something great about that entire opening sequence of Shaft. He's walking the streets of New York. He's crossing the street. He's, the guy honks. He gives him the eye back. I mean, he's a different, he's a man of the 70s. We have left the 60s behind. We have left the 50s behind. This is the 70s, and that movie is so characteristic of that decade, of that attitude, of that new New York. Mm-hmm. New York, as we know it today, was really born in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And had to go through that transitional period. So that's what you have in Richard Roundtree. And just to add, Richard Roundtree has three movies yet to be released. Richard Roundtree never stopped working. Never stopped working. Which is just sort of an amazing thing. You know, we peg him as Shaft, but make no mistake, stopped working, not for one day. So, Richard, love you, baby.
And then lastly, want to mention the very, very sad death of Iranian New Wave filmmaker, pioneering filmmaker, Dariush Mirzoui, who was murdered in Iran. This didn't make a whole lot of the trades, but he was stabbed to death. There are no suspects in the stabbing, and it is expected to event. I mean, it'll never come out, but I think a lot of people, and I'm one of them, think that he was in fact killed by the regime. Made a lot of wonderful films. Hamoun from 1990 is an amazing movie The Cow, his
1969 or so, 69. late 60s. Yeah,
it's a wonderful, wonderful film. Layla is one that I absolutely love. I reviewed that in 1996, you know, The Pear Tree, 98. I mean, he was amazing in the 90s in particular.
Turan, and recently, I guess that's the 2000s anyway. I remember Turan, this is 2000 sometime. I think you're probably right, Wade.
And
the regime.
He gave a speech last year where he talked to in a theater. He talked to an audience and he lambasted the regime for its censorship and said, I can't take it anymore. I want to fight back. Kill me. Do whatever you want with me. Destroy me. But I want my right. And indeed, they appear to have done just that. He and his wife on October 14th were both found stabbed to death in their villa. And, you know, I hope maybe at some point we will find out what happened. But, you know, Jafar Panahi, who is no stranger to his own troubles, was there and spoke at the funeral. These brave Iranian filmmakers who stick it out and have not gone expat. It's very, very impressive.
Darush was 83.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah. He's in his 80s.
About that, yeah.
So, you know, a stalwart in a long life, a long career, pioneer, and I think that was his intention, just to simply call out the system. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're going to hit a few foreign films here. I'm just going to blow through these foreign real fast because these are some really important foreign films we haven't talked about in a little while. Right off the top, I want to talk about Lida. The Myth Comes to Life. This is in 3D and 2D versions on one disc. Really interesting movie. Utterly fascinating, based on a Greek myth. And this is on Blu-ray from Patagon Films and Archive Media. And, you know, if you still have a 3D Blu-ray player, this is not a bad thing to throw on there because it's not like a Hollywood 3D film. But obviously that, you know, that whole technology is harder to come by these days. Mm. But what an utterly fascinating film this is. What a strange, unusual, fascinating movie. It's about a woman who has these hallucinatory visions. And this is directed by Samuel Tressler, IV, and it debut filmmaker, very stylized, very, very impressive. But if you know the story of Leda and the Swan, it's an ancient Greek myth.
The Spartans, I think she is, something like that.
Yeah. It's this kind of modernizes it into this period environment from about, you know, like about 200 years ago is when it looks like it's really taking place. And it's this kind of crusty mansion. And it really is. It modernizes the myth and yet it leaves it in a different period. And the way the 3D is used is really interesting. I had to go, you know, bust out the 3D glasses, which I haven't used on, you know, the one TV here in ages. Like, we only have one TV that's 3D in the house, right? So I went and busted that out. And it really is, it's cool. It's really worth it. And I don't praise 3D very often, but it's worth doing here. But no, it's haunting and it's beautiful black and white photography, really mixed with color at points. It's a little bit experimental, but it's really a wonderful, wonderful modern mythical retelling. So there is that, and I look forward to all the people involved in this who are all involved in the commentary. I look forward to them being involved in other things in the future. Very interesting film. We also have on Blu-ray Rodeo by Lola Kivoron. This is it's basically a rebel youth film. It's in French. It's part of this new kind of there's a new movement in French cinema, which is very much about angsty youth. And it's a little bit where American films were in the 50s. And then again, for a moment in the early 90s, that's kind of, you know, there's some of that restlessness with the young French filmmakers right now. And she basically rips people off. She rips off motorcycles. She has a scam.
I love that movie, dude. That girl in that movie, cool, right? she's captivating. She has this giant gap in her teeth. What do they call that? I forget what they call it.
A diastema.
And she's ridiculously beautiful, and it's just it's just really sort of striking. She was the thing that really made that movie.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a gritty, cool film. It's part of a new thing, which includes, Lage Lee, who did the new Les Miserables, not based on the Victor Hugo. It's basically about the urban area of Paris known as Les Miserables. He did that a few years ago, which was the French submission for the Oscar. It's all kind of in the same mix. We have a great film here from Italian director Emmanuel Crialis called L'Immensità with Penelope Cruz, who does movies equally adeptly in Spanish and in French and in Italian. And this is a very autobiographical film on the part of Crialis. Very interesting movie. There's a revelation from his life that no one knew that he made. Around the time this film was released, I won't get into those details because it's very politically volatile, and I want people to put their politics aside in this, because this is him telling his story in a very personal and non-political way. Growing up in the 1970s and certain coming of age struggles. And this is the story of Penelope Cruz and one of her children. And how they are trying to sort of navigate all of these family issues in the 1970s. Really a very interesting film, worth discussing after you've seen it. Another, Juliette Binoche, who I just met two nights ago, at an event at the French Consul's House with Mark and his wife. She's in a number of films lately, including Between Two Worlds by Emmanuel Carrère. She's wonderful in all of them. This is from Cohen. It's just a beautiful movie. See it for Juliette Binoche. She plays a woman who gets a job. How do I even do this without giving it away? You find out fairly early on. She's an author, and she goes undercover to write about the people who are the working class cleaners on this ferry that goes back and forth between northern France and England. And she keeps it a secret, gets to know these people, and it then eventually takes some interesting dramatic twists and turns. But it's really a wonderful film, and it's actually shot on the ferry. It's not like they recreated the ferry on a soundstage somewhere. Another great French film, this wonderful actress I've never seen before, Laure Calami in Full Time by Eric Revelle. This is, the French make a lot of movies about working. Americans don't. Like, you find a lot of French movies.
We don't anymore. I mean, your Martin Ritz and your
Wade, exactly.
25, 30 years ago, but not anymore.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. But the French are very, unemployment and jobs and work frustration. It's a big part of French culture, always has been. And this woman is just, she's trying to get a decent job. She's a single mom. She's got to somehow make this her commute to this job that doesn't pay her enough, and take her kids, and the neighbor sometimes takes the kids, and she's got to like deal with the daycare for the kids and deal with working this low-end job, hoping that her college education which justifies a better job, that'll pan out, and she's sending resumes. Pretty much this movie is just this woman running. She's running to the truck, to the train. She's running to the bus. She's missing a ride. She's running. She's trying not to be late for her job. She doesn't want to get fired, but she's got to pick up her kids. She's got to help her kids so they can get to school the next day. It's exhausting watching this poor woman in this movie.
It's an extraordinary film. Of course, this is all during this national transit strike, of which there are many.
Yes, right.
Of these strikes of all sorts there. And of course, there's an empathy because the strike is why. Why are these people striking? For a better wage, for a better cost of living, for a better. But what does she need? A better wage. So the strike, the thing that is killing her, is she's caught in the middle. It's an extraordinary thing.
And then we have Lee Rijun's film Return to Dust, which is a beautiful love story. This is not on Blu-ray. This is on just DVD. But it's really just a beautiful, beautiful love story. It is in Chinese, in Mandarin Chinese, comes with a great short film called Hair Tie, Egg, Homework Books by the same director. No, actually, it's a different director. Sorry, Luo Rongxiao. It's a different director. I thought it was the same director. Anyway, no, this is just this is a wonderful rural love story about a farmer and his wife and their rural struggles. And it's, you know, I haven't seen a Chinese film like this in a very, very long time. This is kind of almost fifth generation style filmmaking. So it's not concerned with, you know, technology and Chinese economy and their place in the world. It's just, it's gone back to that wonderful poetic realism that was part of the fifth generation. So that's a beautiful film called Return to Dust. We have Cinematic Sorceress, the films of Nina Menkes, great independent filmmaker who teaches here at, is it Art Center where she teaches? Do you know?
Yeah, not far from me. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but she's been for years, I mean, since the 70s, she's been, you know, a significant figure in maybe 80s. I think it was the early 80s when she really kind of broke out. But anyway, a really significant figure in American independent film. And this is a whole bunch of her films combined here. The Great Sadness of Zohara, Magdalena Viraga, Queen of Diamonds, The Bloody Child, all of these wonderful restorations of these films, and plus a lot of great extras, interviews with her and some of her collaborators, Q&As, audio commentaries on all four of the films, and it's great. This is great American independent filmmaking, kind of, you know, she's been right at the forefront of it for the last 40 years, really nice compilation. And then wrapping this out to with the newer films on the foreign front, Past Lives, which I think all of us really love. Tim, you think this is going to have some Academy Awards love?
Oh, I think so. It's one of the ones that that everyone seems to be really appreciating greatly. And it really is a beautiful film, Celine Song. A great script. Great film too. A great script. I mean, the script is what I love about the film. It's a beautifully made film, but I love the story, the sort of softness and sort of gentleness of this film. These people sort of reflecting on what things would be
on friendship.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And then we also have two of my favorite French films ever, the Marcel Pagnol novels, My Father's Glory and My Mother's Castle, which were made into wonderful movies by Yves Robert. Gosh, it's been, 25 years since?
1990.
Over 30 years. That's how far back we're going. Wonderful. You know, basically came on the heels of Jean de Florette, Manon of the Spring, and they decided, well, let's do another twofer. And they made these, and I just cried because, you know, I lived in the area where Marcel Pagnol grew up. Some of this takes place in Marseille, Parc Borély, which I used to walk every single day. So it's absolutely wonderful, wonderful pastoral family drama, beautiful, beautiful scores, everything about this from Film Movement Classics. Just, I cannot rave enough about this. And they got some great extras on here.
I always love the setting of those films. The setting of those films were before the wars, before both of the wars, before the Great War and the other war. Right. And it was so the dynamic is because after the Great Wars, both of the wars, French cinema and the French landscape, all of it becomes different.
It all changed. Yeah, it did. This is a magical moment. It really is a magical moment. Anyway, they've got a video essay by a French literature professor at NYU here. They've got a featurette with the director, Yves Robert's son, Jean-Denis Robert, and grandson Martin Drescher and the cinematographer. They've got a little booklet in here with some wonderful essays in it by Kat Ellinger, so who does a lot of great commentaries too. And then lastly, we got a couple of compilations here, early short films of the French New Wave and Alain René, five short films. You know, the French New Wave directors, they didn't just make great features, they made great short films. And the Alain René films are just as impenetrable as his features, but you don't have to sit through them quite so long. All kind of from the 1940s and one from the 1950s. Van Gogh is, I think, arguably the best because it's, you know, it's Van Gogh, but there's some really interesting stuff in here. The Paul Gauguin short is nice. And, Guernica is really, really good too, from 1949. And then the early short films, the French New Wave, includes stuff from, Agnès Varda, Truffaut, Godard, Maurice Pialat, who's not really a French New Wave director necessarily, Jacques Rivette, you know, Alain René again. Two discs, a lot of great stuff on here. You know,
a lot of those folks, we're just starting to lose a lot of those folks. Agnès Varda and Godard, what, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, not terribly long ago. I think Alain René, I think he was still around to the early 2000s, maybe 2014, 15, something like that. He did a thing. So these people are just about now starting to slip away. So
they are indeed. It's very sad. It's very sad. A few docs I want to pump through as well, and then we'll jump into 4K and TV and everything else. Docs real quick. We got a great thing on the story of Don McLean's American Pie. It's called The Day the Music Died. Believe it or not, there's a lot to say about this, and it's really worth checking out. Paramount Plus apparently funded this, and good for them, because there's a whole MTV angle to it. But I love that song. You know, my wife actually in college got extra credit in the class once. For on their final, they were told you'll get extra credit if you can write down all the lyrics to American Pie, and she and one of her classmates did it. They wrote the whole, and that's a long. That's like an 8-minute song.
Yeah, a lot of verses. That's crazy.
Anyway, crazy stuff. Clerk, a documentary about Kevin Smith, who is now about 180 pounds lighter than he has ever been before, and healthier. But what a really interesting doc this is. You know, it's really interesting. Malcolm Ingram directed this. He's done some, you know, Small Town Gay Bar is one of the films that he's done. This is a solid 2-hour long documentary about Kevin Smith, his whole and it's subtitled. It's it, you know, like the Geek Who Would Be King is kind of the subtitle to it. Really. Just a fascinating life, more fascinating than I ever thought it would be. Kevin Smith and Ingram both do a commentary on here. There's another commentary featuring the Stanley brothers, which you'll understand if you watch it. And then, you know, some uncut interviews and stuff on there. But the thing that comes out here is that Kevin Smith is a much more serious guy than I think anybody ever gave him credit for. You know, my first exposure to Kevin Smith, and by the way, you can get this at mercantileinstinct.com. mercantileinstinct.com is where you can get it. My first exposure to Kevin Smith came in the 1992 Cannes Film Festival when Clerks was, you know, this grungy little low budget American independent film that was entered in a sidebar section to the main competition festival, which I think it ended up winning. But you have these press boxes at Cannes, right? In the Palais. You go in and every day and you open it up and there's a bunch of crap in there that they put all the little press kits and come to this event and whatnot. It's just, it's your mailbox for the duration of the festival, and it's usually filled with junk. And if you've got anything that you want to promote to the press, you give it to the Palais people and they stick it in the press boxes. I'm sorting through all this and here's a press conference. And the only reason it stuck out at me was Clerks, it's an American film, independent film, and we will be having our press conference at the Monoprix grocery store on the second floor. I'm like, what the second floor of a grocery store? What are you kidding me? Like, and so I go in, and sure enough, here's a market, and everybody's shopping, and there's Kevin Smith and Scott Mosier, his producer, sitting at a register, which is roped off, while other registers check people out, and the press are kind of shoehorned in there between customers with cameras. It was a mess. It was a press conference in the market. Total publicity stunt. There you go.
Hey, look.
First exposure to him.
It's a really fun doc, you know, for film geeks like us. But it's really interesting because this is about a guy who came out of Red Bank, New Jersey, some little in New Jersey.
Yeah.
A video store period. That video store period, our period, you know, VHS and, you know, all that stuff that's in Clerks, and figured out a way to penetrate the industry, you know, from that point of view, and never really from that actual physical space that he never really left. left. Kevin really never came to Hollywood. All day, every day, he was always sort of doing things, mall rats, with, you know, that mall is in Jersey. All that. So that's the interesting thing about him. He's among those filmmakers who were able to do the stuff from places where him, who's the guy that works out of Baltimore? John Waters.
Oh, John Waters, yeah.
Always worked out of Baltimore, figured out a way to do it, but to maintain their spaces. Look, L.A., New York, Chicago, maybe, But these guys who just sort of like from nowhere decide to stake it out and do their thing. And a measure of his success is all the people who show up in this movie that are, related to, obviously, all the people that were in his films, but all kinds of interesting people, including Stan Lee and Penn Jillette.
You gain a real appreciation for him as not just as a filmmaker, but a person.
Yeah. He gave a lot of folks breaks too, Kevin Smith. Good on him for that.
Yes, he did. So other docs, Unstuffed, Build-A-Bear story. I didn't even know about the Build-A-Bear phenomenon until I watched this. I'm like, this is weird. This was a full-blown phenomenon. These custom teddy bear, it's just a weird thing. If you know about Build-A-Bear, the Build-A-Bear workshop, my goodness, what a very strange, ultimately totally American thing. This is all about the building of that company and the phenomenon, which spans, well over a generation. And a lot of interesting people show up in this thing, including, believe it or not, John Lovitz and Mario Lopez. How and why they show up, you got to watch.
Wait, dude, Jerry Mathers?
I know, right?
Mike Tyson. This movie. So anyway,
it's hilarious and weird and creepy at the same time. We've got The Complete Story of Film by Mark Cousins, which is 18 hours. 18 hours. You got to really, really not just love movies, but you got to love the movies that he loves to sit through this. This includes two films: The Story of Film, An Odyssey, and The Story of Film, A New Generation. And really, it's just personal essay stuff. He has done an amazing job of editing together all of these things and these connections that he sees in the history of cinema. Some of it is really off the wall, and I don't know that I agree with it, but I enjoyed the journey. But man, it is, it's a lot. It's 18 hours, man, on four discs. So set it on in the background, let it roll for a few days. tune in when you see something that you like. All Man, the International Mail story. I kind of was hoping this would be like International Mail, like, mail order. No, it's not. It's about the M-A-L-E. This is the story of the catalog, International Mail. And which was a big thing in the 70s and 80s. It was a big thing I use as a double entendre. It sort of emphasized a very particular kind of masculinity that is sort of laughed at now. It's the Chippendales kind of masculinity. And that came and went. Might make a comeback. Let's hope not. But anyway, it's a really interesting story. International Mail is a magazine. Really interesting story. Nuclear Now is a documentary. Oliver Stone directed this, which is all about reconsidering nuclear power. And it's not exactly the kind of film that I would have expected Oliver Stone to get behind, but the angle is, with respect to climate change and cleaner nuclear and,
safer nuclear technology, a lot less waste.
So really kind of an eye opener and again, a good conversation starter. Yogi Berra, It Ain't Over is wonderful. You learn so much about Yogi Berra in this. And yes, it's got all of his funny stuff. His family is, all over this thing. And you get all kinds of great stories about the Yogi Berraisms and all that. But what you also learn is the relationship between Yogi Berra and Jackie Robinson, which is so special. And was he out? Was he not out? The famous tagging at home. I mean, it's and Yogi swears he was out. I tagged him. I mean, it's a great little bit in an overall wonderful movie about a fascinating guy who was, look, I'm not a baseball fan. I didn't know he was like, in addition to just being a guy who said weird, funny stuff and showing up on commercials, I didn't realize he is literally like the most legendary catcher in the history of the game.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know you could be legendary as a catcher. I, as long as you catch the thing. But no, man, catchers are a big deal.
Yogi Berra was the guy that figured out. Yogi Berra was the guy that figured out how to throw people out.
Yeah.
First of all, he was fearless. He's 10 World Series rings. This guy.
I know. Isn't that unbelievable?
That's unbelievable. I was always too afraid to be a catcher. Yeah.
Yeah. The life and times of Allen Ginsberg. I mean, what else are you going to say? Yeah. Allen Ginsberg is like an archetypal figure from the 60s, counterculture figure. You know, writer, activist, all poet, all of that stuff. And this does a very good job of distilling an enormously significant life, whether you love him or hate him. And a lot of people love him and a lot of people hate him. It takes, you know, a good 3/4 of a century of history and centering around this guy. And it distills it into a very, very strong film. And incredibly, it's a short film. It's 84 minutes. It just blows by. But this was made in 1999, and it is still super strong. It is out on DVD, directed by Jerry Aronson, and you get a second disc on this 2-disc set, which has tons and tons of extras as well to supplement the historical perspective. It's great. Also really good, even though our friend Ray hates it and has given me no end of grief for liking it, is The Storms of Jeremy Thomas by Mark Cousins. Jeremy Thomas, you know, Jeremy Thomas's dad and uncle were both filmmakers. His uncle did all of the Carry On films. And which are, you know, just a huge legendary franchise, the greatest franchise in British comedy history. And Jeremy Thomas grew up in the business and became a producer, but making artistic films was his thing. He won an Oscar for The Last Emperor, but he has done so many other significant films that it's, you know, Cronenberg's Crash and Nicholas Roeg's Bad Timing. And, you know, a lot of just amazing films with amazing filmmakers that otherwise wouldn't have had a chance to get made. And that's where he poured his passion. And this is Jeremy Thomas is getting on in years, and Mark Cousins and Jeremy Thomas they hop in a car together and on their way to the driving to the Cannes Film Festival. And he pieces that road trip together with clips from the films and interesting observations. And I just loved the journey. I love the journey.
In recent years, he was executive on EO, that movie about the donkey.
Was that last year?
Might have been year or two.
We're going to talk about that in a minute too, because that's on Blu-ray with us this week. Yeah.
So he's up there, but still swinging.
He's still swinging. You know, do you like Filipino food? If so, you're going to love Ulam Main Dish. We don't have, you know, we have like Los Angeles has a huge population of people from the Philippines. Filipino population there is huge. They're great. They're very deeply in elder care. All the elder care facilities here are run by Filipino families. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of Filipino restaurants, though.
No. No, yeah, no, I know it's absolutely true. You know, would you compare them from other cultures from that portion of the country and the restaurants and the food culture that's represented back here? Not a lot of Filipino restaurants.
Yeah. So I thought this was fascinating, and apparently it's starting to have a rise, and it's going to make a bit of a thing. But no, this is one of those movies that makes you hungry, kind of like the French film, you know, The Taste of Things.
The Taste of Things.
Or Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. I don't see it on an empty stomach. But it's quite good. I'm probably the only person listening to this podcast or involved in it who cares about this. But Lionesses, How Football Came Home, wonderful Blu-ray documentary on the English women's national soccer team, which finally two years ago they won the Euro, and which was the first major championship for British national team since the men won in 1966. And this year they made it to the finals. They lost to Spain, but what a great showing! What a great showing! You know, as long as my U.S. women are disappointing me, and my French girls and my Dutch girls are disappointing me, I'm gonna hang on to my English girls. They're a great team. They're just an absolutely great team. And this was, you know, some of these. I mean, Mary Earps, the goalkeeper, is just spectacular. So many other great players on this team. I really enjoyed it. And then lastly, the great Fog of War is out on Blu-ray from Sony Pictures Classics. The Robert McNamara sits down and talks to Errol Morris about Vietnam and every other damn thing. And it is kind of bone chilling and fascinating at the same time.
Yeah. And again, these are really interesting figures who are sort of drifting away. And context is a hell of a thing. The fog of war, of course, you know, many people have taken that term to task. Many people take Robert McNamara to task.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting way to see how when this group of people came into government, the McNamaras of the world, who were really from a previous generation, they brought into government the knowledge of statistics and accounting.
Yep.
And amateurization, and they started thinking about war in these terms and how the numbers of things, acceptable losses, these sort of things started to become calculable. And that's what Robert McNamara is talking about in this film, and it's really sort of striking.
Very, very true. So we got TV, we got 4K, we got new movies, old movies. What do we move on to here?
Well, let's do a little bit of TV because I've been watching a lot of TV. We can start wherever you want to start.
Well,
it blows me away that NCIS, the 20th season. Of
20 years. These shows just go forever now. You remember when it used to be that, like, oh my gosh, Y5O went for 12 seasons, like double digits. Most series ended at 3, 4, 5 years.
I can remember when if you pulled a three season run, you were the happiest human being in television because a three season run meant that you would get probably 5, 10, 15 years of residuals.
Yeah.
On a 20 season run, you're set for life. It's an amazing thing. Anyway, NCIS 2003. Of course, we recently lost, David McCollum. This is David's show, right?
Yeah.
I got him on the right show because, you know, it's hard to get to.
They cross over in this season too, right? They bring the NCIS Hawaii people in, and, you know, so they're doing the Law and Order thing. And that's kind of, it was CSI started this trend. Then Dick Wolf took it to another degree with Law and Order. And then NCIS gets in on the game, and all the Chicago shows have gotten in on the game, and which is also Dick Wolf. So it just keeps on rolling.
It's an amazing thing. Yeah.
Well, anyway, there it is. 20 years. My goodness, heavens to Betsy. Also, Fatal Attraction season one. Joshua Jackson, Lizzie Kaplan, two actors that I like, but how do you turn this into a series? Doesn't the Fatal Attraction get old at a certain point?
Well, and I got to tell you, we know how the movie ends.
I know.
So, you know, but it sort of frames itself in the same way that 1987 movie with Michael and Glenn Close and Ann Archer is framed up like that. And then it sort of moves along. But it's a good question. Plus, I gotta say, Fatal Attraction. If you say Fatal Attraction to someone who's of a certain age, who's not of a certain age, our age, it doesn't mean anything. At least it's not a reference to us. The word Fatal Attraction, the phrase Fatal Attraction, is a direct reference to that movie that Adrian liked. A direct reference, always. I'm not sure that's true of somebody who's 30 or whatever.
You're probably right. Got a couple of Showtimes here, a couple of Showtime series. Back to Life season two and we got Back to Life seasons one and two, and then I got a couple of Hallmarks. That's what I get for not wearing my glasses. So Back to Life season one and two.
That's the one from Daisy Haggard that's about the chick who was in jail. Is that the right thing? Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, scene. Yeah. She's, you know, coming back to life out of it, coming out of prison. I think what's and I didn't watch this when it, first aired or anything. So I'm kind of, coming at it late. I think it's a really interesting idea to look at a woman integrating back into society after a lengthy prison term. Not something we talk about a lot. I don't know if there's enough here to necessarily sustain an ongoing series. That's the thing. See, the season two episodes seem to be wearing a little thin, a little repetitive. Nicely written and acted, though. It feels like they're squeezing a turnip a little.
What I liked about it is that it's a comedy. I mean, it's not like it's not like a laugh track comedy.
Yeah,
but it's not heavy. It's not meant to weigh down.
Exposure. Yeah, another exposure-y. Yeah, yeah,
there's drama. Sure, there's drama. You know, but there's plenty of chuckles and flat out belly laughs in that show. Yeah. That's what I liked about it. Don't take it too serious, folks.
A couple of Hallmark Channel original movies here as well. Eat, Play, Love and Sun, Sand and Romance. If you have ever seen a Hallmark original movie. So this is what they're like. They're basically like Lifetime original movies, except people occasionally go to church. Is that good?
Oh, absolutely. Good? Okay. Yeah. And in this one, like in most of them, I'm sorry, there's always going to be at least one veterinarian. Somebody's you got to spend some time. Dude, Lee Majors is in this one.
Yeah.
And I'm good with anything that's got Lee Majors just doing anything.
And Lindsay Wagner.
So the $6 million man and the $6 million woman. I'm good.
That's the only thing that really made it worth watching. It's like, oh my goodness. And then it made me want to turn it off and go watch some old episodes.
Only in the other order, the Bionic Woman.
I will tell you this though. When you consider that, you know, when you look at the two of them, you go, okay, Lee Majors, you're looking pretty good for your age. I mean, he's like 80 now, isn't he? He's going to be like 80. Mm-hmm. You look at Lindsay and you go, girl, you haven't aged. What have you done? You're amazing.
She's so beautiful. It's just ridiculous how great she was. And Lee had a moment there in like the, I'll call it the late 90s, early 2000s, where he kind of let it go a little bit. But interestingly, pulled it back together in the later years. He's tightened it all up and got it all back. I'm like, look at Lee.
That's Eat, Play, Love. And then the other one, Sun, Sand, and Romance, it does not have Lee Majors or Lindsay Wagner. It all takes place at a summer resort and, you know, whatever. It's fine. It's gooey. It's, you know, it is what it is. So we talked also about CSI Vegas is in season two. There's not really a ton to share there. It's just CSI stuff. And then there's casinos in it. And then Chicago Med is in its eighth season. I truly can't believe how long some of these shows run. The best thing about Chicago Med is Oliver Platt, man.
Yeah.
I'd like to see him do features again, but he is so good in everything he does. He just brings that gravitas.
Yeah, and as you say, you know, Oliver was that guy in features all through the 90s who was, you know, not the pretty guy, not the handsome guy, but the guy that held the weight, that put the weight in those scenes in a bunch of big-ass movies, you know, with, you know, Julia Roberts and Kiefer Sutherland. What was that one where they were all dead? Yeah, Flatliners, you know. Oliver held that movie down. Anyway, yeah.
Yep, Big Night.
Sherman was in a really great movie with Oliver, our buddy Sherman Augustus, called Zigzag. It was this really, really good film. It's a little bitty film, independent film, but it was fantastic. And Oliver was amazing in that film.
Got a couple of things from the History Channel here. We got the Presidential Legacy Collection, which focuses on Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt. And this is Doris Kearns Goodwin's is the anchor for all of this stuff. Mm. She, you know, produced this and basically oversaw it. She kind of godfathered it, and along with Bradley Cooper. And these are some really interesting miniseries that get in. You know, people don't necessarily understand how the two Roosevelt presidents were related. They just know they had the same Dutch name. That is explored, but each of these things really stands on its own. They're about 4 hours long, each one of them. It's a real investment, but it's utterly fascinating. I mean, you know, kind of docudrama stuff and recreations and a lot of fascinating historical anecdotes that I had no idea about. Really, really good scholarly stuff. So if you can invest the time in each, it's 8 hours between the two. Also from History Channel is Brothers in Arms, which is two films, World War II in HD and Vietnam in HD, all about, those two wars, soldiers, a lot of amazing archival footage. Mm. I mean, you know, really great stuff. I've seen so much of it, and yet there's still more that I just had no idea about. The World War II one is 7.5 hours, And the Vietnam one is almost 5 hours. So again, a real investment there, and a lot of war and a lot of gore to deal with, but it's really worth the investment. It's great, great documentary filmmaking.
Yeah.
Yellow Jackets season two, also on Showtime. I don't know, man.
The first season, I really deeply appreciate it. Of Yellow Jackets, and it was the story that I deeply appreciated, sort of the way it was structured. But I've always thought that this is a story for a movie, or perhaps a limited series,
because a female Stand By Me,
yeah,
kind of a thing, right? Yeah,
yeah. But we got to get to an end of this thing because this thing happened. You know, it's about these women that had this event when they're children, when they're young, and then we go sort of back and forth between, you know, their sort of present day and that thing that happened when they were young. But somewhere along the line, you got to get to an end of this story.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
I'm a big Melanie Lynskey fan. I just
and she's great, and she's really, really great. She is. Poker Face season one, which is I didn't even know this existed, another Paramount show, starring Natasha Lyonne, who seems to do, like, I thought she was still on another show, and now she's on Poker Face, and she just bounces from shows and back and forth.
Ryan Johnson, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, indeed. She basically plays a cocktail waitress who is also a detective. Go figure. I guess anybody can be a detective these days, but it has a kind of a nice 70s vibe to it. The semi-rural out and about background, somewhere between rural and urban America. It just feels, I don't know, feels 70s to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Even the cars. She's driving around in like a 67 Barracuda. You get through this town. And I like some of the folks. I like Natasha, of course, but you got Benjamin Bratt roaming around this thing, which I like a lot. You know, people like that. Adrian Brody pops up here and there. You got Ron Perlman and Nick Nolte popping up here and there. And Judith Light from that old Tony Danza show.
Yeah.
If these people are from the 70s and 80s and 90s and they pop up but they don't bring their personas with them. They come and they play these characters. And I just, Tim Blake Nelson, Lil Real, I really, Tim Meadows, you just never know who the hell is going to pop up in one of these shows. And I really dig that.
Kiefer Sutherland stepped away from 24 for a while and then apparently had the itch to play like a spy again, so comes back for Rabbit Hole, which is in its first season here on DVD, not 24 though, and it feels like it's trying to be 24 without being 24. I don't know, it's part of the problem is it's not like straight espionage, it's corporate espionage, and that just isn't quite as interesting, I don't think. But I don't know. You tell me. What do you think?
Well, I think this is mostly Kiefer wanting to look cool and walk around with a gun.
Yeah, there you go.
So they built a show for him. So that's what that is.
Yeah. Oh, well. South Park, The Streaming Wars. A couple of special South Park events here. The Streaming Wars and Streaming Wars Part 2. It's South Park. They're just making fun of streaming. In a very, very funny way. I'm surprised they made a separate Blu-ray release for those. But, you know, if you're a completist, go dig it up. We get Picard, the complete series. 7 hours of special features tacked on to this very uninteresting show that never should have been made, I think. But I don't know, Tim, you're much more forgiving.
I have things Star Trek and a Picard, absolutely. Want me a Picard. Wasn't the Picard more or less framed as this one? This is set around the destruction of Romulus and some things like that. Now, what I liked about it is that John Luke is 95 years old in this series.
Yeah.
So they've done this math, for that matter. Patrick Stewart is damn near 95 years old. Yeah, I don't know. He might be 80.
He's younger than William Shatner, and he looks 30 years older.
Yeah, you, it's that British thing. And so they sort of account for that. And I like seeing a lot of these folks again, certainly Seven of Nine and all that kind of stuff. Now, the narrative, the actual story, that's the problem. That's the mess. The people, the stuff, the production value is all good. Unfortunately, it's just this really bad story. So for me, it was like watching several bad episodes of Star Trek Next Gen, but I keep hoping that, you know, after that, there will be several good episodes of
For me, it was like watching a daytime soap opera, except they're all wearing Romulan costumes. Romulan politics just gets so hokey at a certain point. They're all aspiring and conniving and speaking English to each other and being sexy and weird. And it's like, at a certain point, I'm like, you know, just stop it. This is like, at least Klingon politics on when you would watch Deep Space Nine or you would watch, you know, Next Gen. Klingon politics, they really went deep on. You know, they will, like, the language, you had to listen closely and go, I don't even know what the plethora of Klarong is, but clearly Article 5 subsection, you know, quint is important to the Klingons because they're devoting a lot to this. You know, like, you bought into it, right? There was a thing. It was like the ancient lore. And here it's just like Romulans being, you know, conniving and sexy and... I can't. I just couldn't go there.
Yeah. I feel you.
Titans. Titans' fourth and final season is out on DVD. I never really watched a lot of this show, but they get the kids and, Robin and Superboy and everybody else. And then somehow it all kind of feels young and sexy and what they did for a long time with the WB and later with the whatever they turned it into.
Gotham and all that stuff. This is way too mystically, magically, I would have preferred it if they had simply pulled characters straight from the sort of universe. Yeah. What's this, the DC universe? Is Batman DC universe?
It is. And the thing is, this is peripheral to the Arrowverse, right? This is the one that doesn't tie into it. They kind of did their own thing. So you got to kind of just leave it alone and accept a whole different universe to this during the Arrowverse.
And I didn't like the universe. It was mystical, magic. Crap.
They also got the complete series on Blu-ray. So what we got here is, you know, the fourth and final season on DVD, but also the complete series on Blu-ray, which comes with a ton of extras. My only gripe with this, and I have not watched it religiously, is they do that thing that they did on the other Arrowverse show. Traveling ship.
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Not Guardians of the Galaxy.
League of Legends. Legends of something or other.
Legends of Tomorrow. Thank you.
Yeah.
We'd see too much stuff. Legends of Tomorrow. Which is that they keep swapping people in and out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just, it's too many to keep track of. But anyway. Ozzie and Harriet, seasons 13 and 14. And you know what blew my mind with this was, I used to watch Ozzie and Harriet reruns. Mm-hmm. But when I was watching Ozzie and Harriet reruns, we had a 13-inch black and white television. And then once we got a color TV, well, and I was on to Get Smart and, you know, Batman and, a lot of other. I never realized that a lot of those reruns that I was watching of Ozzie and Harriet on our 13-inch black and white TV were shot in color.
Oh, really?
The 14th season of Ozzie and Harriet is in color.
I did not know that either.
Isn't that crazy?
And we wouldn't have. So Ozzie and Harriet ran about 10 years. I think it started in 52. Ran 14 years. It started in 52. So
the last season
would have been 64, 5, 6, something like that. 66, something like that.
66, 1966.
So, yeah, I guess we would have been right smack dab at that moment where in living color, you know, that thing that they did at the area. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. 14 years, 435 episodes, and son of a gun, there's color here. And I'm looking at it. I'm like, wow, I know what Rick Nelson's skin tone is. This is kind of amazing. I mean, this is a revelation. I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea. So this is like watching this show for the first time. Seeing these color episodes, I'm like, some of these I'd seen, you know, many, many times as a kid. And I'm like, holy cow, this is a whole new way of seeing it. This just comes to life. And I almost feel guilty. It's almost like it's been colorized.
But not.
But not at the same time. So we also have the complete He-Man and Masters of the Universe series, which recently, this is three seasons, 26 episodes, never liked this show. This is the second of the He-Man series here from television. I never particularly cared for this at all, but, you know, who cares about me? But as a, let's talk for a second about the live action version, which just switched studios. I think Netflix passed on it and somebody else just picked it up. I literally saw that just the other day. So what do we think about a live action He-Man?
When you say live action He-Man, my mind does not go to anything modern. My mind goes directly to Dolph Lundgren. And that movie's, I think Courtney Cox was in that movie well before her turn on Spins. And one of my homies who's in Star Trek Voyager, I can't remember. He's the teenage boy in that movie. So my mind goes there immediately. Now, that notwithstanding, a contemporary He-Man, I don't know, man. The cartoon series was never really my thing either. That live action movie from the 80s was terrible. It was terrible. So I can't see how we get there. Although, you know what I loved in that movie? Skeletor was played by, I'm going to say, I think Jack Palance, maybe?
Oh, no, it was Frank Langella.
Was it Frank Langella who played Skeletor?
It was Frank Langella who played Skeletor, yeah.
And I just remember that actor, he was great. Skeletor was executed in that film. It's like he was in an entirely different film.
I know.
A much better film. but that's what I remember about that. What do you think about the possibility of a new one?
I just, you know, my number one problem with He-Man is his haircut. I'll be honest.
that little page boy.
It's that page boy thing, and all I can think of is Prince Valiant, played by Bob Wagner. That's all I can think of. I can't handle the page boy haircut. It kills me. It just kills me. I don't know who cooked that up, but that doesn't work for me. You know what? There was a moment where being like small people in a world of giants, basically actors working with oversized props, was a thing. I only know it from the Irwin Allen show, Land of the Giants. I don't think I ever realized that there was a previous series called World of Giants, which Irwin Allen had nothing to do with. And this is now out from Classic Flicks. This is from 1959, right? A lot of stuff from the late 50s I didn't, you know, necessarily hook onto because the reruns didn't show up when I was a kid. But this is really interesting Cold War stuff. Do you know about this show?
I did not know about this show. I mean, I like you, Land of the Giants, you know, all those little people in that spaceship and the giant. I love that show. All the props with, you know, the telephones, the pencils.
Yeah.
Well, they had to build. This is amazing.
This has the same deal, but this is amazing. This was a very expensive show to make at the time. CBS made it. And the premise here is that these people are on a secret mission secret Cold War mission. And their rocket explodes and it shrinks this one guy played by Marshall Thompson, who was previously on Daktari. It shrinks him to just 6 inches in size and turns him into this like amazing spy. So he's like this little pint sized Thumbelina, Tom Thumb sized spy now. Right. And he works with a partner who's full sized, played by Arthur Franz. And, you know, there are other, basically, if you imagine it's like Mission Impossible, if Martin Landau were Ant-Man, right? If he were Ant-Man and he couldn't get to be big again. Really very interesting. And it didn't last longer than a season, only 13 episodes. And I feel like it should have had more because there's so much that it could do here. Gavin McLeod shows up on this thing. You know, it's really quite interesting, and it's a great artifact. And bravo to Classic Flicks for bringing it back. Really,
yeah, 1959, fabulous.
The Boys is in season three. I know a lot of people love this thing. Amazon original superhero, dark superheroes, nasty superheroes who are a little bit nihilistic and vain and narcissistic, and it's still a bit of a soap opera. It feels like. I don't know. What does it feel like, Tim?
It is ridiculously sadistic and counterculturals within the context of the Marvel and DC universes. And there's a spinoff now called Gen V, which lives in the same space and connects with all these sort of same characters. It's not something that I was particularly a big fan of, to be honest with you. You know, I get where transgressive thoughts would probably love this, but I'm not a transgressive kind of guy. I like an actual hero. I like my heroes to actually be heroes. Even the heroes in this show are anti. Carl Urban plays this guy who's and he's the hero of the piece, relatively speaking, but he's really not.
Yeah, I get you. I agree. A couple of Paramount series here as well. Wolfpack season one and The Great, the final season, which has now been canceled. And I know that there are some kind of wounded feelings on the part of our actress here.
Elle Fanning.
Elle Fanning. She had some wounded feelings about the fact that this has been now canceled and she doesn't get to sort of finish out the character's arc. Here's the thing. This is also really, really not that historically accurate. Not even remotely.
Not even remotely historically accurate. She's playing Catherine.
So I would argue that whatever arc you thought you were going to finish out is a completely fictitious arc that doesn't exist anywhere in the history.
No.
So, look, I mean, it had a good run and I think it's going to do fine in reruns as a streaming show, but it's these things like the Henry VIII thing with Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, who is anything but like Henry VIII. I mean, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers has a body mass like Henry VIII's thigh. It's ridiculous. So, they're fine. They're fine. Wolfpack season one, on the other hand, I don't know.
That's a Sarah Michelle Gellar, my Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, who I still think of in that way. But yeah,
as a survivor of multiple wildfires, I have a problem with the idea of using a wildfire as a narrative device to trigger this kind of supernatural Buffy-esque saga. It's werewolves, not gonna hide anything here, that's giving it away, but did you have to use a wildfire which has caused so much pain and agony to so many people? That's sort of like, oh, let's do Holocaust and werewolves, not to analogize it, because a wildfire is not the Holocaust, but I mean, I know a lot of people who lost their homes, still haven't rebuilt after 5 years. A lot of my daughter's friends lost everything that they had. It's a lot of pain wrapped up in that. Don't use it as a narrative device.
It's not particularly useful as a narrative device. It is a narrative device. It's a background thing that's going on.
Yeah.
But all it serves to do is to make the story completely confusing. I could not follow what the hell was going on in this show at all.
Yeah,
it was really, really. So that's, and a lot of it had to do with that background.
Getting close to the end here. For All Mankind season one, I had no idea this was a narrative show. I thought this was like the documentary for All Mankind, right? That it was the history of the space program or something. Mm-hmm. And then I watched it. I'm like, oh, I see what you're doing. You're using the same title, but that's not what this is. This is an alternate history thing.
Yes.
It's an alternate history thing where, the space race is ongoing. And you've now turned it into an alternate history a soap opera set in space, with NASA and so forth. So I get
it. The Soviets did this and we did that and all kinds of things happened. And now we're all these people are on the moon doing what's going to be. Yeah.
And we'll see where it goes. Season one is kind of more of a setup, but I'm curious. I'm sort of into it. It's nicely done. Good production value. Really good effects. Terrific effects. And then coming back to South Park, we got the 26th season. I got to tell you, 26th season, just like the 25th. just like the 24th. This show, they're still commenting and poking at everything in the culture, and they, according to Mark, who knows people on the show, they turn these things around in a couple of weeks,
which is so amazing because in 1990, whenever the hell that it came, six or seven, 26 seasons of what, something like that, the show, it was exactly the opposite, which somehow it became this expensive and very slow show to make, having to do with animators in Korea, South, it all kinds of things. And then, which was interesting in and of itself, because, you know, Trey and Matt, you know, they made this, you know, basically stick figure of the show that had been floating around on that VHS, and I'm sure you got a copy of way back in 90 like everybody else. And then over the years, it became this very expensive show that took a long time to make. And now, because the technology has changed so much in the ensuing 20 plus years, almost 30 years, it's a show that can be turned around almost instantaneously, which is why they can put out so much material. That streaming one that you talked about, you know, and they can just spit it out. But the content stays straight, great, without losing the quality. The images and the animation, which was never, you know, special, is the same as it always was. So all you have to do is, you know, keep the content tight, and you can go on forever.
Yep. There it is.
Yeah.
So I'm going to wrap out on a few more Hallmark things. So a lot of the Hallmark stuff comes from Canada. They make these movies in Canada with tax incentives. They're usually schmaltzy. They're good for Canadian TV, and then they sell them to Hallmark, and Hallmark makes a killing. That's how it works. And Lee Majors thing with Lindsay Wagner, that's from Canada. And so are these next two, 14 Love Letters and Love Unleashed. Oh, my gosh. Wait a minute. Hallmark original movies with the word love in the title? How unusual is that? What a strange thing. So Love Unleashed. Cute girl. She has a puppy party. Guy comes over, adopts a puppy. They fall in love. There you go. Two people love each other and they love the puppy. Starter kid. There you go. There's nothing else to it. Then this is a Hallmark Movies and Mysteries original movie, The 14 Love Letters, which means that there's more to it than just romance.
No.
There's a mystery. And the mystery is, who keeps writing these love letters and sticking them in her mailbox? Well, she's got to go find them. And of course, it turns out that it's this disgusting fat guy with bad height. Oh, wait a minute. No, it's not actually. It's a really hot guy. He's really hot. He is. How often does it happen that you have a secret admirer and that secret admirer is not some disgusting basement dwelling stalker with mental illness? No, he's a really hot guy who could be a magazine model.
Look, the director of that particular one is a young woman named Amy Force, who I've met a few times. This is where I met Amy a long time ago. Amy was an actress. She's a young woman, a young girl actress. You're running around all those, I guess they were Disney and shows, all this kind of stuff. You know, so Amy comes up and, you know, she does her thing. She's in all those movies and stuff like that. She becomes a script continuity supervisor, you know, because she's doing, and sort of starts to work her way over onto the directing side. She's directed at least five or six of these things, if not more at this point, and has really built a real serious career as a filmmaker, directing these. Santa's got, they do a lot of them for Christmas. You know all the Christmas ones.
Oh yeah.
And I got to tell you, she gives a lot of folks work, and a lot of actors that you know show up in these things. I'm not, you know, I don't engage in a lot of this stuff, but I have to ask myself. This is a real thing. There are people making whole careers out of these movies, acting in them, writing them. Our buddy Ray is connected to a guy who works on a lot of these, and it's a thing. And I'm going to quit making so much fun of them. That's what I'm going to stop doing.
And I am making fun of them good naturedly because they have their following.
Good naturedly, yes, absolutely.
We need some pick me up.
Good work, Amy.
Got a couple of Hallmark Channel original series here, both of which are not bad. I got to be honest. Season one of both of them, The Way Home, they're both multi-generational family sagas. That's what they have in common. And The Way Home is basically about, you know, it's a matriarchal family. These many generations of women, and Andy McDowell kind of holds it down and is wonderful in it. All the actresses are great. Some good, solid melodrama in here. And, you know, Grant Harvey directed, Marley Reed wrote. I think it's a good, solid show. Mm-hmm. The one that I enjoyed is Ride, season one. So here's what Ride is. Take Yellowstone. It's no longer set on a ranch. It's now a rodeo dynasty. Swap out Kevin Costner. Swap in Nancy Travis.
Mm-hmm.
Done. Oh, it cut the budget by like 90%.
Yeah, it's cheap. Thing. It's a cheap show, yeah. But Nancy Travis is hotter than Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
So, you know, the McMurrays working on keeping that ranch going. I love it, man. I just love it.
It's I didn't know that there were rodeo dynasties, but I guess there are.
There are raisin dynasties, dude.
I know there are like almond dynasties. I found there's like an almond family in California. They're billions. I'm like, almonds? Billions?
I don't even like almond milk. There it is.
I guess, whatever. Shall we do the 4K?
All right, baby.
Let's do 4K. So we got, all righty. We got three steelbooks here, 4K steelbooks from Sony, Columbia, TriStar, that whole thing. And they're all really gorgeous. The steelbooks make everything better, obviously. But first of all, Black Hawk Down, Ridley Scott. Okay, we were just ripping on him for Napoleon. Black Hawk Down, similar deal. It's, you know, it's expertly made. Still looks great. The sound is phenomenal. I mean, truly, crank up those speakers. This thing will just soar. My only problem with Black Hawk Down, notwithstanding the fact that it's true story, and we all know that horrible story, and this is loaded with wonderful extras, real-life interview, audio commentaries, but real-life interviews and everything else. The problem I have is I can't tell who's in this movie.
Shot,
they all look the same. I remember at the end when the credits were rolling, I was looking at everybody who's in this movie, and I'm like, what? Eric Bana was in this movie. Which one was Eric, Ewan McGregor?
Josh Hartnett and Tom
Josh Hartnett. I didn't know. Wait, how are all these people in this movie? They all look the same. Their faces are all dirty. They're all wearing helmets. Somehow I confuse them all with each other.
Yeah. Very energetic film, but yeah, I can't. I got to tell you.
Rudy, we all love Rudy. True story. Mm-hmm. The guy never really was much of a football player, but he got on. He played that one game at Notre Dame, and that's all that really mattered. It's just like, you know, you got a small dream, you work hard to get it. Sean Astin's lovely in this movie. It's David Anspar, you know, directed it. It's got a lovely score by Jerry Goldsmith. Mm. It's a real favorite for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. The little Jon Favreau, Charles Dutton, you know, all these really wonderful
guns. And Guns of Navarone, which is way better than its terrible sequel with Harrison Ford, Force 10 from Navarone, which is just dreadful. really just terrible. But no, Guns of Navarone is a good, solid J. Lee Thompson, actioner, just, you know, one of those great World War II movies, kind of from that 60s period, right, with Dirty Dozen and Great Escape and all that. It kind of slots in there, right, with that. And on 4K, it's terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Great commentaries with J. Lee Thompson and film historian Stephen J. Rubin, documentaries about the film, about the, you know, the real events and all that stuff, behind the scenes featurettes. It's really, really great. So
look, youngish Richard Harris.
Yeah.
Ridiculously young James Darren. Ridiculously young James Darren, yes, in that film. He's like a baby or something in that film. And, you know, and David Niven walking around that British, that with that little mustache.
Yeah. It's a solid film.
Yeah.
Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part One, which shockingly to me underperformed at the box office. Here's my question. First of all, I think this movie's terrific. I love all the Mission Impossible movies, except for JJ's, actually. I don't like the third one. I think it's lame. But and the John Woo one is a little ridiculous. But I think they've been very, very solid since. They're ridiculous. They make no sense. I don't care. I'm all into my cruise. But this is Dead Reckoning Part One. Mm. Some great female parts in this thing. I love how they use women in these.
Hadley and yeah.
Oh, they're all Rebecca. So good. They're all so good. And you know, Isai Morales is being set up as a hell of a bad guy for the next one. But here's what happened. Because the first one underperformed, the part two was supposed to be released next June. They pushed it to 2025.
Mm.
Now,
did that have anything to do with the strike, or was it simply about the underperformance?
I think it's both.
Mm.
I think they're concerned that this thing underperformed. They want to give people a little time to discover this, to let it breathe, and to reconstruct what they did wrong in the marketing the first time. I think part of it was because Tom and the cast were doing these big premieres all over the world with fireworks. They went to Paris, they went to Dubai, to New York, to Sydney, right? They were doing, they did like a dozen different premieres around the world, but they did them 2 weeks before the movie opened because they knew the strike was coming.
Mm.
And I think once the strike hit, they couldn't do what usually helps these films maintain legs, which is do the talk show circuit, do the PR circuit after the movie is opened or right the week of, get people into it. If you're doing all these premieres 2 weeks before the movie, that's a long time in a movie life. 2 weeks, 2 weeks later, the movie opens. Nobody's on a talk show. There are no talk shows. Nobody's doing any kind of press. It's really hard.
Yeah. The notion probably is that they would be able to push it. Look, I like this movie a lot, but I will say one thing about it in a number of the Mission Impossible films, and you may have brought this to my mind, maybe it was Mark or Alan, but this is an action film.
Yeah.
Mission Impossible was not an action series.
No, the series was not. No, that's right.
It was an espionage series. Yeah. And the first movie was an espionage movie with an action sequence. And little by little, that has changed. It has swapped in these films.
Yeah.
They're almost all action films, fully action, and with very little, quote unquote, espionage
that's
going on.
That's why I think at a certain point, when Tom Cruise is done with the series, there's a great opportunity to reinvent it along the lines of what Soderbergh did with the Ocean's 11, 12, 13 films, right? Those are not action. Those are all about the trickery of the scam, the heist.
Yeah, the heist.
You know, people in disguise and in the costumes and doing this and that and the other thing. And there's a great energy to those films. I think that's where Mission Impossible can go once Tom Cruise checks out, which I think is after this last chapter of Dead Reckoning.
Hmm.
Anyway, some good extras on here, great stunts, but to be honest, I would almost, and a good commentary with Christopher McQuarrie and the editor, but I would almost wait until Dead Reckoning 2 comes out in 2025 and then get the two in a single nice big splashy set. I got a Best Buy exclusive Steelbook packaging, 50th anniversary final cut release of The Wicker Man. I don't know if The Wicker Man, after 50 years, deserves this treatment, a Best Buy exclusive in a Steelbook on 4K, because it is really just basically a horror film of the era. It's still kind of Rosemary's Baby light, you know. I mean, look, it is. It's the original. I can't stand. What's the guy's name who did the freaking 3 hour Joaquin Phoenix horror thing where he and his mom.
Oh, Ari Aster.
Ari Aster is so far up his own unit. It drives me crazy. You know, like, I am not a fan of Midsommar.
Oh no!
But that's basically still The Wicker Man. It is. Midsommar is The Wicker Man.
Sure. Yeah. Look, there's Edward Woodard, who of course would go on to play The Equalizer on television. Yeah. And Christopher Lee. There's a certain sort of thing. It's gorgeous. There is that big bonfire that probably reveals itself in those really sort of neat costumes that they would wear. But I don't know that all of that calls for 4K and
I mean it's still considered a classic, but I mean, I don't know if it deserves this treatment. I enjoy it, but not that much. Bronx Tale on 4K, 30th anniversary. Can't believe it's been 30 years.
Wow.
I know, right? Chaz Palminteri, it was originally a play, and he adapted it into a film, and Robert De Niro directed it. And, it works. It still feels like a play. It's still one of those Goodfellas movies. It's still in that Scorsese, Coppola, gangstery genre. A little bit light, but honestly, I think the film still has some really good stuff in it. It's got some good writing. Chaz Palminteri's it's his high point, his career high point, and I think it's worth checking out. I don't know if it's 4K worthy. I don't know if it's 4K worthy, but There it is.
Yeah, yeah. No, De Niro did a good job on that. And that kid, Lillo, I think is his name, Brancato, is the kid that plays De Niro's in that movie. People forget De Niro's actually in that movie. He plays the dad, because a lot of people thought that De Niro should have played the jazz parliamentary part, Sonny, or whatever his name is. No. He chose the exact right thing to do, particularly since he was directing. Play the smaller part, play the dad. If he plays the other guy, then he's, you know, he would dominate the entire film.
Exactly.
And the film is really about the kid.
Yes, precisely. Let's talk a little DC stuff here. So we've got Justice League and RWBY Superheroes and Huntsmen Part 2. We covered this in Part 1. This is no better. It's just really mercenary to combine those two worlds. That's just fanboy hell. Mm. But let's talk about Blue Beetle, because everybody really tried to make this movie succeed. And did not. It tanked. And it tanked hard. And on the heels of The Flash tanking, it's really put the
Black Adam
it's put the whole DC world in a bind,
just all of that.
So the people tried to make a thing. Well, it's the first Latino superhero, and I don't, you know, that you still gotta have a good movie, man.
It's a narrative problem here. We got a story problem here, and everything else the same, but this story is not captivating.
It is a minor DC hero. It's not a significant thing. The Nun 2. Did we need a sequel to The Nun?
I don't think so.
No, I mean, it's ongoing from the Conjuring universe. They're trying to turn that into a universe. And I love her. I think she's
Farmiga, Tessa. I think
Tessa Farmiga, Vera Farmiga's younger sister, who of course plays the young version of her in the Conjuring universe and things like that. I think it's perfectly lovely, but I don't know if we needed a second one of these.
It's good to have a big sister who's a movie star.
It sure is.
Who you look slightly like.
And they're like 20 years apart.
In age.
You know?
She played Vera's daughter in a movie some 5 or 10 years ago. But it was perfectly believable. And I kept thinking that she was Vera's daughter, and I had to be corrected. That's her little sister.
She's also on the Gilded Age, which is she's wonderful in the Gilded Age.
Yes, she is. Too. She really is.
Mortal Kombat Legends, Cage animated. No, that's as much as we're going to say about that. It's on 4K. No. Meg 2, The Trench. Because we needed this.
Well, here's the thing about this terrible movie. This terrible movie cracked me up. I'm not going to say this. I had to see this for the radio show. It's a terrible movie. It cracked me up. It's plainly obvious that this movie is not really constructed for the North American market. If you look at this movie, you see all of these Chinese movie stars running around you, and then Jason Statham. You're like, oh, I see what's going on here, which is fine. But it was terrible, but it was funny.
The fact that somebody said, hey, let's just remake Jaws, except let's make the shark like 900 times bigger and pretend that it's prehistoric.
Everything in this movie gets eaten by something a little bit bigger. So they show you a thing get eaten, and then they show you something eat that thing, and then they show you something eat that thing. And I suppose that's the point of the film.
It's really good 4K. That's what I can tell you about it. It's really nice to put on in the background there. I am, of course, saving the best for last here for anybody who might be wondering, why aren't you getting to just you will get there. Another steelbook that we have, Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon, which is a film that I suspect Tim and I are quite fond of and nobody else is. You know, this film came out at a very opportune moment. It's a period when we're kind of stitching the 70s to the 80s. It's mid-80s. It's 85, but it still has a foot in Xanadu. It still has like one foot in Xanadu and one foot in Thank God It's Friday and maybe a couple of feet in The Wiz. I don't know.
I was going to say a little bit of left. Michael Schultz, of course, directing Vanity, Vanity from Vanity 6 in the film. And of course,
DeBarge is in this.
DeBarge.
How many people younger than you and I even know what DeBarge is?
There's a whole family of them, folks.
There's a whole family. El DeBarge, man, that guy.
And Ernie Reyes Jr., who had the fastest. He played tight. He had the fastest feet. You remember Ernie? Ernie was a bad kid. Ernie was a bad kid. Ernie's got to be 50 now. I say Ernie. Yeah. But I don't know if they're in Julius Carrion Shownuff. He was Shownuff. Yes, I'm sorry. I love this film.
It's a great film. The whole thing is Berry Gordy just said, I'm going to combine all the things I love, which is martial arts and soul and disco and R&B and, you know, we're going to Motown and sparkle up the martial arts, and we're going to make a movie called The Last Dragon. And it is quite a thing. It really is. I have a lot of fun with it. I think it's a great artifact. The fact that it's on 4K tickles me to no end.
It's a bright and punchy movie. It really is. I mean, a lot of primary colors in this movie.
Yes.
And vanity, dude. Vanity's in
the movie. I know, right? Stephen King's The Mist, 4K Collector's Edition, Best Buy exclusive, also steelbook packaging with a plastic sleeve. They went to town. I just don't think The Mist is remembered. This was kind of Frank Darabont laid an egg with this a little bit.
I never cared for this film. Now, there are fans of Stephen King. Stephen King films with Stephen King, who are nuts about this, Thomas Jane and Marcia Gay Harden, everybody in this movie, and inside that supermarket, and something's in the mist, and it's out there, and they go out, and then of course has that sort of particular ending that it has,
yes,
which was really what bugged me about it. You know, I did that, it was an interesting, almost 12 Angry Men sort of thing when they're all trapped in the supermarket. And then it sort of devolves.
Frank Darabont is an expert filmmaker, even when he's not really on his game. And he came, you know, he had come out of doing Shawshank and Green Mile and all this stuff for features. And he tried to bring a lot of that juice to this thing. And it is, I'll tell you, in 4K, it looks better than it's ever looked before. It really is. Mm. It's a beautifully mastered, beautifully reconceived thing. I think they did a lot of work on the color and certainly remixed it, but it just still kind of misses the mark for me, or missed the mark. So we're getting down to the last three here, the two best of the last. Talk to Me, 4K, a hands down horror classic. Clark Collis, Entertainment Weekly. No, I don't think so. I disagree with that poll quote. It's like Ouija. Remember Ouija? Mm-hmm. Ouija board. It's that, except they have they do away with the Ouija board and they bring up this embalmed hand. Which, you know, just brings the ghosts hard, and everybody screams and bad things happen, and it's kind of formulaic, but it's respectable formulaic, I guess. It's not embarrassingly bad, and that's maybe the best thing I can say about it.
What are those brothers named? Danny and Michael Philippou or something like that?
Danny and Michael Philippou brothers.
Yeah.
They do a commentary. I didn't listen. Yeah. The late great Jean-Luc Godard made his greatest film in Contempt, otherwise known in French as Le Mépris, which is now out on 4K, the first 4K of a Godard film. Can I emphasize that?
Wow.
This is a Godard film on 4K. It's been out before on Blu-ray, and you can get from Lionsgate a package that also includes the Blu-ray, or you could just get the standalone 4K. So it depends if you have a Blu-ray player and you want to be able to play it. Otherwise, the 4K only has a 4K disc. That's all it's got. And I just think this is one of the great films of all time. I wrote essays on this in school. Mm. You know, Bardot has never been more beautiful or more stunning. Michel Piccoli is amazing. It is considered self-reflexive. It's one of those movies that, one of the first shots is Godard pointing the camera right at the camera.
Mm.
And Jack Palance is that crazy Hollywood director. The whole thing was shot at Cinecittà. It's a great movie. It's a great behind, and shot on, you know, this wonderful widescreen CinemaScope, these beautiful colors that just pop in 4K. Amazing. I just can't say enough about this. I am so thrilled that this is out on its 60th anniversary.
Extra. Look, I just love that film. I'm an Alphaville guy. I mean, if we're talking good idea, Alphaville. But that is just extraordinary. What's her name? Brigitte
Bardot.
Bardot. She went a little sideways. Honestly, later in years, the one that didn't is the extraordinary Sophia Loren.
Oh my goodness.
Sophia has never gone sideways. For one thing, she's still beautiful. And she's never gone sideways. Her mind is clear. She still works. You know, had a film a couple of years ago that one did her son directed. And Deb and Brigitte, well, what are you going to do?
So the last 4K here, let's talk for a second about Barbie. 1.25 billion dollars, the most successful Warner Brothers film dollar for dollar in history, beat all the Harry Potter movies, the first $1 billion movie since before the pandemic, saved Warner Brothers, saved the movies along with Oppenheimer this year, which almost made $1 billion. Is it all that?
Well, look, I thoroughly enjoyed Barbie. Thoroughly enjoyed it. If you had told me, suggested to me, you know, this movie's going to make $1 billion, you know, 2 weeks before it came out or whatever, or anytime before, I'd have told you were crazy. I'd have told you that. It'll probably do well. Actually, Margot was coming off a couple of rough moments. Margot Robbie coming off of that tough situation from that. What was the one she did? Babylon. And whatnot. So she was dealing with, you know, taking the brunt of the heat from that as though that flop was her fault.
Yep.
Which was irritating. But I would not have pegged this at being $1 billion movie. Now, I wouldn't have pegged Oppenheimer at being $1 billion movie either.
Me neither.
So, you know, apparently rocks. And the thing of it is, they're counter programming one to the other. These two movies were making money at the box office together, literally at the same time. And very interesting.
And the people who were like, oh, it's the Barbenheimer thing. People are going to see them both. I said to people, Ray tried to tell that to me. I said, no, they're not. There is nobody. There are no 22-year-old girls who are going to see Barbie. And then their next thought is, hey, let's go see that 3-hour movie about the guy who invented the atomic bomb. No, they're not going to do that.
No,
they're not going to do that. No. And it came out when they did the audience surveys, Barbie primarily women, but women in their like 30s, right? Women in their 30s. It wasn't even the young women. It was in their 20s, yes, but a lot of women in their 30s because it was nostalgia, right? And Oppenheimer, heavily men over 50, right? 40 and over 40, over 50. I mean, different audiences. So
totally different audiences, but enough income there to support two hits.
Yes.
In the middle of a summer at the same time. If that exists, that exists. That being said, at any given moment, you can have two big ass movies making a whole lot of money, at least.
Two non-Disney, non-Marvel, non-Lucasfilm, non-Pixar films that do not have a universe or a sequel element to them, not based on anything other than, in Barbie's case, toys, and in Oppenheimer, a real person.
Yeah.
But no pre-existing cinematic IP that they're working with.
Not even a book, not a novel, not an article, nothing, none of that. Just, you know, the scripts had to be written from. There you go.
Barbie looks amazing. I'm going to be straight up honest. You know, all that whole pink vibe that this thing had going. And I have to say, on Halloween, you see the saturation of pink in the culture. Everything, when we're taking our daughter trick or treating, everyone was dressed as Barbie or Messi. Messi wears the pink jersey for Miami in soccer now, right? Barbie, everything in this movie is pink. It was pink everywhere on Halloween. I've never seen such a pink Halloween.
Yeah, you know, I love pink. Pink is my.
Well, I mean, I have some narrative problems with Barbie. I thought they could have done more with the fish out of water stuff, but on balance, I am very happy with what the film did and what it represents overall. And I could not be more happy for Greta Gerwig.
Well, my favorite thing in Barbie, Greta's fantastic. I love you, Emerald Fennell is in Barbie. Midge, she plays Midge. Yeah. Which is one of the funnier sort of incarnations of all the kinds of Barbies that are in the show. And Emerald, of course, has, what does she have? Emerald, you know, that she won that screenplay Oscar for a couple of years.
The
Promising Young Woman. She has Saltburn coming out. which I think I told you at the top of the show I saw the other day. And of course, you know, you see Emeril and it's just everything. I think she was in Call the Midwife for a while. I know she's played somebody in The Queen series. Yeah. You know, and so I think that we probably need to say of Emeril Fennell, hey, kid, good work. You're doing good work. You know, we love Greta and everything. But I got to tell you, this Emeril Fennell kid is fantastic. Yeah. And she's doing good work in front of, behind the camera, writing scripts. I think we need to elevate her, Greta, all of these young ladies. Yeah. Excellent work, young ladies. Excellent work.
Yeah, agreed. Shall we wrap out with a few new movies?
Right, baby.
Just non-4K. All right, King of Killers. So King of Killers, it goes like this. Somebody says, hey, you know what? Let's make a John Wick knockoff. Great idea. Okay, how much money do we have? About $16. Oh.
Well, first thing, you know what we're going to need? We're going to need Frank Grillo. we can get him for $14.95. But, you know, Kevin Gravois. So Kevin Gravois.
Yeah.
Who has that brother with this voice? You know that voice. Has that voice. Who, of course, actor, of course, but also wrote one of the writers, one of the creators.
Yeah.
Of that that vampire series. What's the name of that vampire series that he created with the beautiful actress in it? Oh, Kevin, let me find it real quick.
I don't think I even knew this. I mean, the thing about Kevin is Kevin is a little bit like a Dolph Lundgren character.
Yeah.
He came to movies. He's like a genius engineering guy, like one of those MIT guys.
Oh, Kevin went to Howard he has a degree in microbiology.
That's what it is. He's like a
master's degree in genetic engineering. He can literally make me and you.
At a certain point, he just got the filmmaking bug, and so he basically makes these kind of low budget action films.
Yeah. Well, the Underworld series. That's the series. The Underworld.
I did not know that.
Okay. Yeah, he created that series, and and then he has this sort of physical presence in this voice. He's in this movie too. He wrote and directed it,
and he's in it too.
I'm just glad he got the shot.
Absolutely. And in fairness, I mean, we're making fun of this. Frank, basically, this is like the premise here is that there are a bunch of Frank Grillo is this evil hitman who wants to know that he's the King of Killers. So he basically rounds up all of his rivals and puts them in kind of a kill or be killed death match thing to see who survives, and then he will fight the one that survives. That's the way that it goes. Yeah. And it's rather silly. Stephen Dorff is in this. None of it is particularly well made, but you know what? It's got Frank Grillo, and I always root for Frank.
Don't hurt you.
The movie here that I'm going to highly recommend is Animal Crackers, animated film. This was on Netflix. It's a whole thing that deals with a magical box of animal crackers that turn people and that transform people into animals and back again. You'll get it. Don't worry too much about it. Just enjoy the plot of it. Here's what Sylvester Stallone does a voice. Danny DeVito is hysterical as the circus guy. Forget it. Here's the thing. Let's get to the cut to the chase. Tim and I have some friends who are producers. And Marcus and George.
Yep.
And we had a great meeting with them, about some of their projects and, stuff we want to do together. We had a great meeting, and they've got an Animal Crackers poster on their wall because they put the initial financing together for Animal Crackers.
Uh-huh.
And it's signed by the director and the whole thing. It's like, they're like, yeah, it should be coming out soon. Sweet. Had that meeting. Come home. And my wife says to me, I just got hired to deliver Animal Crackers to Netflix.
This town is so strange. I said,
you realize that I just met with you. She goes, yeah, I need to call them right now. I'm like, are you serious? Like, what are the odds of this? This is ridiculous. This is hysterical. Nuts. Literally the same, not just the same week, not even just the same day, the same hour that we were meeting with them. My wife is getting hired to deliver their film to Netflix that we just saw the poster of. I get home and it happened all at the same time.
It's just so nuts. This town is just,
Like, in what other business does that happen?
Yeah. Kevin Gravois is a voice in Animal Crackers. just to bring the point home. Tiny town, folks.
Bring it all home. We love Nicole Holofcener. I think she's one of the best American filmmakers working. I hate that so much of her stuff gets stuck going straight to streaming. But this one, not necessarily. necessarily. This is an A24 film released on Blu-ray from Lionsgate. You Hurt My Feelings with Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Tobias Menzies. I love this film. I can't. This is one of my favorite films of the year. I'm almost certain this is going to be right near the top of my top 10. I think this is an amazing movie. Did you get a chance to see this?
I haven't seen it yet.
It is so great. So Julia Louis-Dreyfus is a novelist who's really struggling. Her career is really, you know, she's trying to get people, you know, like all these novelists, she just wants to write a good book and have people read it. Her husband's a therapist. And there's a question of whether or not he's being honest about what he says about her book. And there, you know, there's another couple in the film, and it all gets into the dynamics of honesty in a relationship and the struggles of artists. And yeah, there's kind of the same dynamic that you get on The Honeymooners and I Love Lucy, right? You know, the women are confidants and the husbands are confidants, right? So where you have these two couples, but, you know, they also break apart guys against girls every once in a while. And there's that dynamic here, which is dramatically always very, very helpful. But what a beautifully written and directed film. Funny, touching, sad, hilarious, and true. Nicole Holofcener is a gem. Also guaranteed to be near the top of my top 10 is Air. So freaking great. This is interesting because Air was a it's not Netflix. Who put Air out?
It was Air Amazon Prime.
Let me look. It's Amazon Prime. Prime. And what's interesting about it is that it has been released on Warner Brothers. Home video through their MGM license, but this is one of the rare Warner Brothers that does not come with a Movies Anywhere code because it's Amazon Prime.
It's Amazon Prime. They don't want
Amazon Prime. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you got to watch it on TV on Amazon Prime or you know, get the Blu-ray standalone. Anyway, if you don't know, Air, I think, is the best film that Ben Affleck has ever directed, and it's just absolutely superb. It is the story of Nike and the Michael Jordan shoe deal. And I know if that sounds like, yeah, that sounds kind of boring. No. Trust me. There were three movies that came out earlier this year. They're all kind of sort of telling the same story. There's Air, there's Tetris, and then there's Blackberry, which is a Canadian film. And they're all sort of doing the same thing, which is they're taking either Jordan and the Nike shoe deal or the success of Tetris as a video game or the success of the Blackberry. And they're going back in time and saying these were underdogs facing incredible odds who somehow rose to the top of their industry in this reckless, crazy period of the 80s or in the case of Blackberry, the 90s. And they're all sort of doing the same thing. Air is the best of them by far because it doesn't need to fabricate like Tetris invents this whole black ops espionage thing happening in Russia. Air is just straight up the story of how Nike, which was not a huge company at the time, Adidas was the 800-pound gorilla, how they, you know, Matt Damon is the basketball guy and Ben Affleck is, you know, the CEO of Nike. They're all trying to, you know, Michael Jordan is entering the NBA. Yeah, but we would want, you know, why don't we go for, you know, these guys, they're likely to go higher in the draft. And these guys, you know, everyone's trying to figure out, you know, the shoe promotion thing. Everything changed. The Air Jordan deal changed sports. It changed shoes. It changed marketing. It changed everything. And it's an amazing story. And they are all so good. And the best choice in this film is they really don't make Michael Jordan a character.
No, he's not a character. You see the back of his head or something. But Dolores Jordan, Viola Davis. Mike's mom.
Yeah.
Although not in the film that much, nevertheless makes her presence felt. Yes. The actress and the character, and you really you come to understand something very important about that family and the way that family worked, and the intelligence and where the sort of savvy and intelligence comes from in Michael Jordan. Yeah. It comes from his mama. That's where it comes from.
And the scene where Matt Damon's character decides he's not even gonna he's gonna break everybody. Christmas Cena as Jordan's agent. I have to say that
he eats the scenery.
He is so amazing. I mean, I love that guy. He is the best. He's the best actor never to win an Academy Award or even be nominated. But he was in line in front of me, by the way, at the premiere for Killers of the Flower Moon. I looked at him, I'm like, oh, it's Christmas Cena. I think I'll just stand here and be a normal person and not say to him, you're so good in Air. It was not going to be that guy.
He would, anyway, he probably would have appreciated that.
He probably would have. Yeah. Yeah. And Jason Bateman just takes a total supporting role here. Chris Tucker shows up for like, you know, 10 minutes and to do his shtick. I mean, everybody kind of, you know, plays their role here. Nobody tries to show anybody else up. It's great. No, but there's my favorite moment in this, my favorite piece of acting is the guy who plays Jordan's dad. Can't even remember the guy's name, the actor.
That's Julius Tennant. I know Julius from a bunch of different things. And again, I love the way they shape that. Yeah.
He has the most honest moment, which is when Matt Damon shows up. Matt Damon drives to their home and shows up at their doorstep to make the solicitation. And he's working on a car. Jordan's dad is working on a car. He's working under the hood. And he looks up and he smiles. And Matt Damon says, hi, you know, I'm so-and-so. I'm here from Nike. And dad smiles and he goes, here we go. It's this beautiful moment, right? They know it's coming. They know their kid is amazing. They know that money and those offers are going to flow. The game begins. Game on. It's a wonderful moment. That smile and that here we go. It's just beautiful.
And he immediately hands Matt.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Over to Dolores. Yes. let me take you to the boss.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to keep working on this car, but you two have a talk.
Everything's going to be fine for us. I love that. It was so good.
Also, the Wallace and Gromit shorts have been out of print for a long time. Lionsgate had the license last. It expired. God bless the people at Shout Kids, Shout Factory, Shout Studios, Shout Kids. They pick that sucker up because they know their audience, and we now have Wallace and Gromit, the complete cracking collection on Blu-ray again. So you don't have to buy any of those UK imports or anything else. And this includes not only A Grand Day Out, The Wrong Trousers, A Close Shave, and A Matter of Loaf and Death, two of which won Academy Awards. It includes Cracking Contraptions, which is these 10 short shorts about all of the crazy things that Wallace invents that, you know, help in the modern world. It's just absolutely wonderful. My daughter grew up on these. I'm so happy to have it in the house again. It's fantastic. Wallace and Gromit, the complete cracking collection. Thank you, Shout. Few others here before we wrap out. The Last Voyage of the Demeter. I don't remember. Did you actually wind up seeing this or not?
Oh, that's the Dracula thing, right?
So they say.
The not Dracula thing. I didn't get through all that movie, to be honest with you. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not good. But here's the thing. What makes it sort of interesting is it's basically Alien. It's basically Alien. And the premise of it is interesting. The Corey Hawkins, who's a very, very good actor, plays a guy who is the first black graduate of the London Medical Academy. But because of that, and we're 19th century here, he can't get a legit job in a hospital. So he takes a job as a ship's doctor, which just happens to be the ship that has a whole lot of ugly stuff in its cargo, one of which is Dracula, who eventually wakes up and starts, you know, murdering everybody on the ship. And all of that is straight up Alien. It's just it's a monster on a ship killing people, and you know they're trying to stop it, and everybody dies except for one guy, and you know, not Sigourney Weaver. It's this case, it's Corey Hawkins. So there you go. That's it. But the end of this thing, which they intend to set up a sequel, that's interesting. The interesting movie is the last 5 minutes. The rest of it, I could do without. Anyway, this thing was, they've been trying to make this thing for 20 years. Gerard Butler in Kandahar. I don't know why he keeps making movies like this. He's a CIA guy in Afghanistan, and his cover is blown, and so he's got to, you know, fight his way out. That's really all it is. Lots of guns, lots of explosions, lots of Gerard Butler and his facial hair. Otherwise, I don't know. Gran Turismo. Did you ever play the game?
A little bit. Way back in the day. Sure.
I've never played the game. What do you, how does the movie?
I did not understand this movie. This movie, Neil Blomkamp, you know, District 9 and all of that stuff there. This movie to me felt like a game. A game in which I didn't have a controller. And I'm like, what the hell am I watching this for? But I don't know. No, it did not quite do it for me.
Well, and then two last final titles, Jules with Ben Kingsley. This is basically E.T. with Ben Kingsley and an alien that doesn't really look like an alien. It's like somebody in a suit. Ben Kingsley is an old guy in a small town, and he's always complaining to the city council, and he's, you know, his daughter thinks he's going crazy, and then a flying saucer crashes on his property, and there's an alien that he lives with and, you know, tries to keep secret, and all the old people. It's E.T. with old people. That's what it is, right? It's all the crazy old people, and the kids think they're crazy. There's nothing else to it. It's kind of sweet.
Did Mark Turtletaub do, I want to say, Miss Sunshine? Is that him?
Yeah, producer.
Okay,
yeah. He's produced a ton of films.
Yeah.
He directed this one, but he's a huge producer. And I mean, it's kind of sweet, but I mean, there's nothing spectacular about it. My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, a lot of people who, I guess, still need work and went back to the well.
No, I agree.
Yeah. Nia still looks great.
Everybody looks great. Yeah, this one's set literally mostly in Greece.
Rita and Tom Hanks still produced. Yeah. They still threw their weight behind this thing, but is it offensive? Is it horrible? No. Is it necessary? No. Not in the least.
It's got all kinds of things going on in this movie, and a few. Yes, no, that's okay.
Well, there we go. All right, that's it for this week, everybody. Good blow through. We're gonna try to get back here with a holiday show and some gift guide recommendations before long. We got a lot of other stuff in the works too. Meetings today, so we'll hopefully be able to break some news to people soon if all that pans out. In the meanwhile, Tim, you're headed home for Thanksgiving.
You're gonna do a little business around my mom's and Thanksgiving, then be back. Take care of a little business here. All kinds of stuff going on, dude.
All right, man. To you and everyone else, have a great Thanksgiving. We'll have more on award season and holidays and all the rest of that stuff the next time we see you. We'll be right back.